14. Contact Through the Veil. 2. This chapter will describe two of the most complex cases of contact with beings we saw in our New Mexico research. While qualitatively similar to the reports we heard about in the previous chapter, they stand out by virtue of their detail and intensely personal meaning to the volunteers, Rex and Sarah. Their stories exemplify how far DMT, the spirit molecule, can take us into worlds and vistas that we cannot begin to imagine. These particular sessions are the full blooming of this absolutely unexpected and profound series of experiences. They also left me feeling confused and concerned about where the spirit molecule was leading us. It was at this point that I began to wonder if I was getting in over my head with this research. The experiences were such that my models of the mind, the brain, and reality started seeming too limited to absorb and hold the nature of what volunteers like Rex and Sarah were undergoing. They also caused me to start wondering how adequately we were able to support, understand, and help our volunteers integrate these otherworldly experiences. Were we opening up Pandora's box? How were volunteers going to live their lives from that point on, after having experienced such an inexplicable but certain reality? What could we tell them that would ease their confusion? Sarah was DMT 34, and Rex was DMT 42. By the time they volunteered for the studies, more than 2.5 years after the DMT project began, we had gained a familiarity, albeit an uneasy one, with tales of encounters with intelligent life forms. If their sessions had taken place earlier in the research, we might not have been as supportive of their telling, nor learned the level of detail we did. Rex's and Sarah's sessions may have been so extraordinary because they quickly suspended their disbelief and shock when the spirit molecule threw open the doors to the unseen worlds and introduced them to the inhabitants of those places. They both had been through a lot in their lives, and were remarkably able to keep their wits about them in stressful and frightening circumstances. They entered those types of situations trying to learn everything they could from them, disregarding nothing, accepting as much as they possibly could. Rex was 40 years old when he volunteered for our studies. While in the armed services, he had taken some PCP or angel dust, thinking it was THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. The resulting psychosis landed him in a psychiatric hospital for a week. He had gone to college for several years, but financial hardship and homelessness ended his studies. He suffered an episode of depression after a divorce in his 20s. Despite these setbacks, his current emotional health was good, and we had few concerns about his ability to manage our studies. Rex was a rugged-looking fellow, but he was much more mild-mannered than he appeared. His dark eyes, hair, and mustache were accentuated by his pale skin. He was the only volunteer who referred to me more often as Dr. Strassman than as Rick. While a journeyman carpenter by trade, he had also won some local awards for his creative writing. He was loosely allied with the Wicca religion, a nature-based practice and community. These were Rex's reasons for volunteering. "I want to explore the potentials of the mind, the nature of actual and perceived reality, and our relationship to reality and to God. I hope to gain at least greater self-knowledge." Rex's response to his first dose of DMT, the non-blind low dose, was surprisingly strong, and I knew he would be having some powerful experiences the next day. At 5 minutes after the low-dose injection, he said, "There was a humming sound. I couldn't tell if it was the air conditioner. Then I felt like I was suddenly in the presence of an alien or of aliens, vaguely humanoid. There were serpentine colors surrounding them, producing an outline of their shape. Based on my reading, I expected leprechauns, not anything like this." The bed was spinning, rocking. It was uncomfortable, alarming. There was some constriction in my chest. That feeling then turned into the alien presence. I tried to make contact and relax into it, It seemed a lot more in control than I was. It was interested in my fear and in me. I remember that feeling from when I was a kid. When I was scared, I would relax and say to myself, "The worst thing that can happen is I'll go to God," when I was afraid. I knew that the next day he would have a potentially cataclysmic encounter with the beings he had just encountered. It seemed only fair to warn him, to prepare him as best I could, based upon others' experiences. Nevertheless, it felt strange to hear myself say, "They do seem interested in you, in people, especially in their feelings." He tried to sound casual. "Cool. Be ready to be dismembered tomorrow. I know that's a grim suggestion, but it sounds like you may be in for a fairly rough ride." I awoke nervous that next morning. How would Rex do? We both were alarmed by his reaction to a dose 1/8 of what he'd received today. We got right down to business. He told me, "I guess I'm most afraid of the vertigo, of getting sick." His comment reminded me of a Tibetan meditation practice I had learned many summers before. The method was simply to ask yourself over and over again, "Is this what I am?" With whatever answer you gave, my body, my job, my relationships, it was important to ask again, "Is this what I am?" My body, mind, identity, opinions, feelings all began falling away. This meditation upset me so much that I ran outside and vomited. I wondered if something similar weren't occurring with Rex. Sometimes nausea and vertigo can relate to something that you're not wanting to acknowledge, something deep but obvious. Is there anything important these days that you're trying not to think about? "I broke up with my girlfriend about 6 weeks ago, and I called her this morning. I'm not sure if it was a good idea to break up with her." Women. Relationships. Trust. "How about your marriage? What was that like?" "She was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic. She was horrible. She did terrible things to me." Time for a leap. I suggested, "So there's a commitment fear in a way. Commitment means getting exploited by somebody who is totally crazy." "Yes." And he made the connection. "Also, I was afraid of the physical reaction to the drug, that I was going to get sick and die from the allergic feeling that I had to it. I wondered if I was allergic to it, with that pressure in my chest and head." Steering back to his emotions, not his body's symbolic dealing with them, I pressed Rex, saying, "The commitment issue is important. A commitment to yourself, and then the commitment to not having a self once that happens. I guess ultimately a commitment to a faith that you will be looked after and not be abused when you're in need." We went on in this vein for a while. Within half an hour, Rex seemed much calmer, although I was feeling sick to my stomach and dizzy. That seemed a signal that he had expelled his fear and it had landed in me. I told him we could probably start now. I walked briskly up and down the hall a few times, splashed my face with cold water in the bathroom, and felt relatively normal. Rex lay very quietly for the first few minutes after the injection. I see in my notes the following comment after remarking upon how still he was. "Thank God." At 7 minutes, hives began forming on his neck. Laura pointed to the vial of antihistamine we had handy in case the hives became too severe or the allergic reaction spread to his lungs, and he began to wheeze. He did have an overactive allergic system. As if sensing our concern, he reached out his left hand and Laura took it. At 10 minutes, Rex removed his eye shades. He started, "When I was first going under, there were these insect creatures all around me. They were clearly trying to break through. I was fighting letting go of who I am or was. The more I fought, the more demonic they became, probing into my psyche and being. I finally started letting go of parts of myself, as I could no longer keep so much of me together. As I did, I still clung to the idea that all was God, and that God was love, and I was giving myself up to God and God's love, because I was certain I was dying. As I accepted my death and dissolution into God's love, the insectoids began to feed on my heart, devouring the feelings of love and surrender. It's not like LSD. Things really closed in around me, in comparison to the spaciousness that I feel with LSD. There was no feeling of space. Everything was in close. I've never seen anything like that. They were interested in emotion. As I was holding on to my last thought, that God equals love, they said, "Even here? Even here?" I said, "Yes, of course." They were still there, but I was making love to them at the same time. They feasted as they made love to me. I don't know if they were male or female or something else, but it was extremely alien, though not necessarily unpleasant. The thought came to me with certainty that they were manipulating my DNA, changing its structure. And then it started fading. They didn't want me to go. Remembering many previous stories, I said, "Yes, they are interested in us and our feelings, and no, they don't want us to go." The sheer intensity was almost unbearable. The forms became increasingly sinister the more I fought. "I'm going to need therapy after this. Sex with insects." Still grasping at a psychological explanation for these strange experiences, I tried this. "That's them. Your fears, your limits." Rex wouldn't bite. Maybe. I don't know. It was nonverbal communication. "Even here, even here," was not spoken in words. It was an empathic communication, a telepathic communication. At about 28 minutes, he didn't yet quite seem back. "How do you feel now?" "Right now? My body doesn't feel quite my own. There is still something of the other dimension flowing through it. I feel permeated by something else." "How about emotionally?" Emotionally, I'm slightly euphoric. "Glad to be alive?" He laughed, looking at me in a more focused manner. "Yes, glad to be alive." "You may have passed out as they were feeding on you. I wouldn't be surprised. That would probably make most people faint." "That's right. That's true. Depending on the person, it could throw them over the edge. Is it self? Is it other? I just don't know. I just don't know where these things come from." As was often the case, answering the rating scale helped Rex fill out some of the gaps in his description. He echoed what many volunteers stated when they thought about the reality of their encounters with these otherworld beings. "This question about being high. I don't know. I had my capacities. I was able to observe quite clearly. I didn't feel stoned or intoxicated. It was just happening." Rex came in for several pilot study days for the Pindalol project. First, he would get a dose of DMT. After all effects were gone, we would give him an oral dose of Pindalol and then administer the same dose of DMT 90 minutes later. At that point, the Pindalol would be exerting its maximum effect on serotonin receptors. The 0.05 and 0.1 milligram per kilogram DMT doses without and then with Pindalol were relatively uneventful. We used the time to process his high-dose encounter with the feasting alien insects. "I now have the feeling that there's something more that I can't access in my daily life. I guess it's the feeling of having made alien contact. I guess I have an expectation of that contact in everyday life. I hope for it. I know it's there." I had to ask, "What is the nature of alien sex? Would you say it is like intercourse, or is it more the feeling, or what?" "It's positive and warm. Maybe it's like an after-sexual effect, feeling alive and alert. Rex then came in for 2.2 milligrams per kilogram doses, one with and one without Pindolol. He seemed moderately affected by the first 0.2 dose. I realized the intense pulsating buzzing sound and vibration are an attempt by the DMT entities to communicate with me. The beings were there and they were doing something to me, experimenting on me. I saw a sinister face, but then one of them somehow tried to begin reassuring me. Then the space opened up around me. There were creatures and machinery. It looked like it was in a field of black space. There were brilliant psychedelic colors outlining the creatures and the machinery. The field went on forever. They were sharing this with me, letting me see all this. There was a female. I felt like I was dying. Then she appeared and reassured me. She accompanied me during the viewing of the machinery and the creatures. When I was with her, I had a deep feeling of relaxation and tranquility. I was happy he finally was finding some support within his trips. At last, a friend. Yes. She had an elongated head. I guess the guardians were keeping me from seeing her. Trying again to interpret his experiences psychologically, I said, "The guardians are your own stuff. They're just the things that prevent you from seeing what's there." And again, just like last time, Rex gently rebuked me. "I know, but they do seem like something else. They seem like guardians, gatekeepers." He continued, "They were pouring communication into me, but it was just so intense. I couldn't bear it. There were rays of psychedelic yellow light coming out of the face of the reassuring entity. She was trying to communicate with me. She seemed very concerned for me and the effects I was experiencing due to her attempts at communicating. There was something outlined in green, right in front of me and above me here. It was rotating and doing things. She was showing me, it seemed like, how to use this thing. It resembled a computer terminal. I believe she wanted me to try to communicate with her through that device, but I couldn't figure it out. We returned in about 90 minutes, knowing this session, 0.2 milligrams per kilogram DMT with Pindolol, might be the most intense DMT experience Rex would ever undergo. I warned him, "Considering how intense your first 0.2 session was, this may be pretty wild. Are you ready?" "I guess." Rex's blood pressure was quite high at the 2-minute point, 180 over 130, and I gestured for Laura to check it again at 3 minutes. It remained high, and his heart rate was slowing, a normal physiological defense mechanism to protect the brain and other organs from too high a pressure. However, he looked well. At 5 minutes, his diastolic blood pressure, the bottom number, remained over 105. I thought to myself, this is too high a blood pressure response. At 12 minutes, he took off his eye shades, looking shocked. "I have a sensation that is really strange. It's kind of like lying in a hot bath. Are you warm?" "A little. Mostly I'm drowsy. Things about the room look funny. It came on real strong. I thought it would last and last and never go away. It was the same place, neon lights defined everything. I was in a huge, infinite hive. There were insect-like intelligences everywhere. They were in a hyper-technological space." He lifted his arms above his head, looked at his right hand, and laughed. "At one point I felt wet stuff hitting me all over my body. They were dripping stuff on me. Everything in there was friendly. I don't think I lost consciousness, but I can't bring it all back." He stared at the ceiling, perplexed. "I'm sorry, doctor. I can't remember." "It's okay. You came back. That's all that matters." struggling. There was one that was with me by my side. There was the same pulsating vibration. They wanted me to join them, to stay with them. I was tempted. Maybe that's where you went, that you can't recall. I was looking down a corridor that was stretching out forever. That may be where I lost it. The buzzing and kaleidoscopic shifting was intense and went on for a long time. Then it let up and I was in that hive. There was another one helping me, different from the one I saw earlier this morning. It was very intelligent. It wasn't at all humanoid. It wasn't a bee, but it seemed like one. It was showing me around the hive. It was extremely friendly, and I felt a warm, sensual energy radiating throughout the hive. I decided it must be a wonderful thing to live in a loving and sensual environment such as that. It said to me that this was where our future lay. I don't know why it said that or what it meant or if that's a good thing or not. I recall telling myself as I was coming down, I want to remember. I want to remember. But I can't. Where had Rex gone? Who were the insect-like beings with such a keen interest in and complex relationships with him? Devouring and consuming, but also loving and nurturing? My attempts at suggesting a personal psychological meaning fell on deaf ears, something that routinely occurred in our volunteers whenever I tried to help them interpret their experiences in that manner. Rex was at peace with his experiences, and he incorporated them into his understanding of the increasingly complex and symbol-rich dreams that began developing. He also started reading more seriously about psychedelic plants and shamanism. Before one of his last Pindalol days, he asked me to look at a festering mole on his leg. I urged him to immediately consult with a dermatologist who diagnosed malignant melanoma. Rex could not be in any more studies until his cancer was worked up and treated. Thankfully, the melanoma had not spread, and he was treated successfully with simple removal of the tumor. By that time, though, I had left New Mexico. Sarah entered the DMT project when she was 42 years old. She was living with her second husband, Kevin, their young child, and two older children from her first marriage. Sarah worked as a freelance writer and was attending graduate school. She was a solidly built woman with red hair and twinkling blue eyes. Her manner was direct, and her mischievous grin often emerged during conversations about any and all topics. Sarah probably had suffered from the most serious depression of any of our volunteers, having overdosed on prescription tranquilizers in her mid-20s. She had to be involuntarily hospitalized for 2 weeks after her suicide attempt and subsequently took antidepressants for several years. Nevertheless, her mood had been excellent without any medication for over a decade, and she was one of our most content and insightful research subjects. Sarah told us that an angel had visited her once when she had had a high fever as a child, and she now had spirit guides, with whom she communicated for advice and support. She considered herself more sensitive than most people to healing and psychic energies. Sarah practiced the Wicca religion, as did Rex, and they knew each other through the greater Wiccan community. Sarah volunteered for this study for personal understanding and expansion of consciousness. I hope I will come to a deeper understanding of myself and my relationship to the universe and unseen worlds. Her fears hinged on being lost in an abyss and of not being brave enough to face the challenge. Sarah's low-dose experience was typical of that of the other volunteers, pleasant, relaxing, with a sense of more to come. Her high-dose session the next day, however, was deep and profound. Let's turn to her notes, which she sent me within a week of that morning's events. Rick said, "All right, we're going to start now in about 15 seconds." His hand was cool on mine, a comforting last connection to reality. I tried to count the heartbeats, something intellectual to hold on to. I got to three beats. There was a sound, like a hum that turned into a whoosh, and then I was blasted out of my body at such speed, with such force, as if it were the speed of light. The colors were aggressive, terrifying. I felt as if they would consume me, as if I were on a warp-speed conveyor belt heading straight into the cosmic psychedelic buzzsaw. I was terrified. I felt abandoned. I'm completely and totally lost. I have never been so alone. How can you describe what it feels like to be the only entity in the universe? There are sounds, high-pitched singing, like angel voices. But they aren't comforting. They are very impersonal and don't care about me. They are simply part of the background noise of blasting through the void of the universe. It felt like going backward from life in a physical body, to life as simply an energy form with no body. The essence of who I am was alone in the void, back in the staging area for life where souls wait to incarnate. I was in a place where there are no physical life forms, only colors and sounds. The singing angels were there only to observe me, not to comfort me. But even though they didn't comfort me, I did bring back an incredible sense of love. A male presence tries to communicate with me, but I don't understand. I use my mind to ask, "What?" The reply is garbled. He is trying to tell me I will see something. "But what?" I try to ask. "Will I know it when I see it?" The presence tells me I will see something. Is it by the horizon's light I see in the vast darkness? There is a great roaring sound. It interferes with the voice because I know it is a jet out there. I'm coming back. The voice is gone. It starts with my face seeming to harden up, become firm rather than nebulous. I feel the blood pressure cuff inflate. The rest of my body comes together and I know I'm completely back. I lift up the eye shades. I feel a deep and poignant love for Laura and Rick, whom I see first. I turn my head to see Kevin. What a beautiful relief. Sarah also came back for the tolerance study. Let's again refer to her notes from that remarkable day. They require almost no additions from the ones I took at bedside. Dose number one. The first trip was lots of spinning colors. I was scared, but I kept telling myself, "Relax, surrender, embrace." Then I saw what I can only describe as a Las Vegas casino type of scene, all flashing and twirling lights. I was rather disappointed. Here I'm expecting this profound spiritual experience, and I get Las Vegas. But then, before I had much time to be disappointed, I flew on and saw clowns performing. They were like toys or animated clowns. I had the overwhelming urge to laugh. I was kind of self-conscious about it at first, but I couldn't contain myself. And I laughed out loud watching those clowns. Rick told me the clowns are a common experience. In fact, he said, "Oh, you saw the clowns?" As if they were old friends or something. Then he said, "Yes, they're hilarious." I felt more confident and not as scared. Dose number two. This time the aggressive spinning colors were almost familiar. Suddenly a pulsating entity appeared in the patterns. It sounds weird to describe it as Tinkerbell-like. It was trying to coax me to go with it. At first I was reluctant, because I didn't know about finding my way back. By the time I made up my mind that I did want to go with it, I could tell the drug was starting to wear off, and I wasn't high enough to follow it. I told it, "I can't go with you now. See? They want me back." It didn't seem to be offended and, in fact, followed me back until I sensed it had reached its boundary. I felt like it was saying goodbye. Re-entry was slow, and I was reluctant to take off the eye shades. Everyone's eyes were so sparkling when I took off my eye shades. I knew Sarah was on the verge of some breakthrough, but that her strong reaction to the colorful hallucinations were somehow holding her back. Can you stop short of contact with the colors? You can't help seeing them, but you can stop yourself from responding to them. She asked, Is it best to hope and intend for something, like to see that little pulsating, shining creature again? The best is to have no intention. If you intend something and it doesn't happen, you'll bump against it. You'll react against it. Just feel your body lying in bed and try and empty your mind. She nodded, and we all paused to look out the window, remarking on the beauty of the thunderheads building in the spring sky. Sarah looked exhausted. Dose number 3. I realized what Rick said was true, that the most intense part of each trip was spent tangled up in these colors. This time I quickly blasted through to the other side. I was in a void of darkness. Suddenly, beings appeared. They were cloaked like silhouettes. They were glad to see me. They indicated that they had had contact with me as an individual before. They seemed pleased that we had discovered this technology. I felt like a spiritual seeker who had gotten too far off course and, instead of encountering the spirit world, overshot my destination and ended up on another planet. They wanted to learn more about our physical bodies. They told me humans exist on many levels. I needed to reconnect with my body in time for the blood pressure check and blood sampling. It was as if they, rather than Laura, were collecting the information, and they appreciated my doing it for them. Somehow we had something in common. They told me to embrace peace. I could feel myself begin to slip away from them as the drug wore off. As I started to come down, I saw these things from their world that I really can't describe. I thought of how the South Pacific natives could see only Captain Cook's small boats, and not his big ships, until they actually climbed on board and touched them. The re-entry was very difficult. I felt sort of lost, but I sensed a tractor beam of Kevin's love and followed it in. My notes state that Sarah got up to use the bathroom. Upon returning, she said, I'm tired, but I'm ready for the fourth dose. This is the last dose. You can really go for it. Kevin added, Make sure you return. At 5 minutes, her blood pressure and heart rate went up higher than they had all morning, even compared to her 2-minute reading, when people's responses are usually greatest. She obviously was exerting herself, but at what? We would find out only later. At 10 minutes, my records indicate that she murmured, We have things we can offer you too. Spirituality. Okay, hurry up. Right there. Right there. I did it for you. There. You can go out. Sarah's notes from dose number 4. I went directly into deep space. They knew I was coming back, and they were ready for me. They told me there were many things they could share with us when we learn how to make more extended contact. Again, they wanted something from me, not just physical information. They were interested in emotions and feelings. I told them, We have something we can give you. Spirituality. I guess what I really meant was love. I tried to figure out how to do this. I felt a tremendous energy, brilliant pink light with white edges, building on my left side. I knew it was spiritual energy and love. They were on my right, so I reached out my hands across the universe and prepared to be a bridge. I let this energy pass through me to them. I said something like, See? There I did it for you. You have it. They were grateful. I was coming down off the DMT, losing altitude. I would have to go back. I was a little disappointed that experience was spent giving, when what I wanted was spiritual enlightenment. Should I have asked for something to take back first? I guess I don't feel comfortable in my role as an earthly spiritual emissary. But I did my best. I always knew we weren't alone in the universe. I thought that the only way to encounter them is with bright lights and flying saucers in outer space. It never occurred to me to actually encounter them in our own inner space. I thought the only things we could encounter were things in our own personal sphere of archetypes and mythology. I expected spirit guides and angels, not alien life forms. My own notes add this little exchange toward the end of her session. I saw some equipment or something, sticks with teardrops coming out of them. It looked like machinery. It may have been machinery. Sarah's notes describe her state of mind after these sessions. It's difficult to sort through all this. Was it real? It certainly seemed real, but so do dreams when they are happening. But there was something about this that was different from a dream, even the lucid dreams I sometimes have. Were there really other life forms out there? Did I really send them the power of love and spirituality? Even more disturbing, did they somehow mark me? Are they watching me somehow? It makes me feel a little crazy and very confused. Even worse, I feel very isolated in my experience. How can anyone except someone who has been there understand? Maybe this stuff did make me go nuts. I know it sure changed my life. Now, what am I going to do with it? How do I keep something this big inside? I was not at all familiar with the alien abduction literature before beginning the DMT study. Neither were many of our volunteers. I knew almost nothing about it and had little desire to learn more. It seemed much more fringe than even the study of psychedelic drugs. However, once we began hearing so many tales of entity encounters, I knew I could no longer plead ignorance of the larger phenomenon. Despite my better judgment, I now feel compelled to weigh in with my opinion regarding the experience of contact with alien life forms. Let's review the popularly reported alien abduction experience. We will see the striking resemblance between these naturally occurring contacts and those reported in our DMT study. This remarkable overlap may ease our acceptance of my proposition that the alien abduction experience is made possible by excessive brain levels of DMT. This may occur spontaneously through any of the previously described conditions that activate pineal DMT formation. It also might take place when DMT levels rise from taking in the drug from the outside, as in our studies. Our current culture is fascinated with the alien abduction experience. Psychiatrist John Mack has published many reports from abductees, people whom he now calls experiencers, in his books Abduction and Passport to the Cosmos. As the event begins, Mack says, consciousness is disturbed by a bright light, humming sounds, strange bodily vibrations or paralysis, or the appearance of one or more humanoid or even human-appearing strange beings in their environment. Mack emphasizes the sense of high-frequency vibrations many abductees report, which may cause them to feel as if they are coming apart at the molecular level. Some find themselves in familiar environments, like a park with swings, and figures emerge out of the background. Abductees also often find themselves on some type of examining or treatment table. Experiencers are absolutely under the aliens' control. Despite the obviously unexpected and bizarre nature of what they are undergoing, there is no doubt in their minds that it really is happening. Thus, they describe their experiences as more real than real. Varying degrees of anxiety occur in this preliminary stage, especially if it feels as if one's consciousness is separating from the body. For many, the experience of fear is by itself somehow transformative. Letting go into the terror seems to change the nature of the experience from negative to positive. The individual may float or otherwise make their way into a curved enclosure that appears to contain computer-like and other technical equipment. Once the person arrives, strange beings are seen busily moving around doing tasks the experiencers do not really understand. Abductees commonly report seeing energy-filled tunnels and cylinders of light in these environments. The typical alien looks like the ones portrayed commonly in the media. Large head, skinny body, big eyes, small or no mouth, gray skin. However, Mac also reports frequent descriptions of reptiles, mantises, and spiders. Some abductees feel there is some kind of neuropsychological reprogramming, or an enormously rapid transfer of information between the beings and experiencer. Aliens may communicate using a language of universal visual symbols rather than sounds or words. Many abductees report a complicated scenario revolving around the aliens using their reproductive machinery to breed human-alien hybrids. However, Mac reports that the hybrid project is by no means all that happens. They may be gazed at closely, and otherwise examined, probed, and monitored. Sometimes the experiencers feel that their health is being followed, especially through anorectal and colonic examinations, and they even report healings. On other occasions, the experiencers report probes being inserted into their brains through the nose, ears, and eyes, and they may feel that their psyche has been transformed. Implants are inserted under the skin, and they may feel certain that these represent some sort of tracking or monitoring devices. Abductees report that the beings appear to be greatly interested in our physicality and emotionality, seeming, as is said of angels, to envy our embodiment. They need something that only human love can provide. This may even take the form of alien-human sexual encounters. These experiences can range from cold and bodiless to ecstatic, beyond what is known to them in earthly love. As Mac describes, the experience of connection between one or more of the alien beings and the abductees with whom they relate is a powerful and consistent aspect of the experience. Commonly, the initial memories are of cold, indifferent contacts in which the aliens, especially the gray reptilian or praying mantis-like beings, render the person altogether helpless. It is common for abductees to feel as if there is one alien in particular with whom they have a special relationship. It's as if this alien is in charge. The relationship may later evolve into a greater sense of familiarity, meaningful connection, and even love between the abductee and the alien. Several of Mac's subjects report that they are greeted by the aliens when they emerge into their reality. The aliens say telepathically, "Welcome back." Some report a lifelong series of encounters beginning in childhood. Experiencers often report that the aliens are urgently notifying them that Earth is in danger. Their abduction relates to this, inasmuch as they either provide reproductive material for the hybrid project or decide to spread the message of environmental degradation to a wider audience. As Mac's work with his subjects has progressed, he notes another common, perhaps even basic, element of the abduction experience. This is the transformational and spiritual nature of the encounter. The collapse of space-time perception, a sense of entering other dimensions of reality or universes, a feeling of connection with all of creation. Abductees' sense of belonging in that realm may be so acute as to create a yearning for it, a desire not to come back. Many abductees no longer feared death, knowing that their consciousness would survive the body's death. One even considered the idea of killing himself so that he could return to the blissful state he encountered during his abductions. The resemblance of Mac's account of the alien abductions of experiencers to the contacts described by our own volunteers is undeniable. How can anyone doubt, after reading our accounts in these last two chapters, that DMT elicits typical alien encounters? If presented with a record of several of our research subjects' accounts, with all references to DMT removed, could anyone distinguish our reports from those of a group of abductees? Shocking and unsettling as they were, Contact with life forms from another dimension was never on the list of volunteers' reasons for participating in our research. Neither was it something I expected with any frequency. Rather, it was the transpersonal, mystical, and spiritual states to which they aspired. It is to these that we now will shift our attention.